everything around is covered by ice, one passenger wrote in a letter. We think that by the time this letter will be found there, there is no more ice in Arctic, unfortunately. Curran and McLaurin's discovery alarmed climate action advocates. The R at the Arctic time capsules left in the ice 2 years ago have already washed up in Ireland the stage of climate disaster, tweeted Michael Whitney, a photojournalist and former fundraiser for Senator Bernie Sanders. The discovery of the time capsule is just the latest evidence of rapidly melting ice in the Arctic. As Common Dreams reported recently, the Laptev Sea in Siberia had yet to begin freezing as of October 22nd, an unprecedented delay brought on by the heating of the planet. In September, federal scientists in the U.S. reported that ice in the Arctic had shrunk to its second lowest extent since records began 4 decades ago. The 14 lowest sea ice extents have all been recorded in the last 14 years. European Union experts also warned last month that 2020 is on pace to overtake 2016 as the hottest year on record. With the U.S. now withdrawn from the Paris Climate Agreement, a decision made by U.S. President Donald Trump in 2017, which sparked international outrage and became official recently, the news of the time capsule was very troubling to the Irish physician Ophie Thomas Doyle. Meanwhile, many people in high places are still in denial about the reality of climate change, she tweeted. How much proof do we need? According to reports, in the past decade, Arctic temperatures have increased by nearly 1 centigrade. Arctic sea ice has reached its second lowest extent in the 41-year satellite record. Last year, the Greenland ice sheet lost a record amount of ice, equivalent to 1 million tons every minute. With annual snowfall no longer enough to replenish the snow and ice lost during summer melting, scientists fear it has passed the point of no return. A Nature climate change study predicts that summer sea ice floating on the surface of the Arctic Ocean could disappear entirely by 2035. For €29,600, the Russian-owned 50 Years of Victory takes passengers on 14-day expeditions to the North Pole, calling it a magical destination.
Economic divide.
Like many nations in South America, Bolivia has been through a lot in the last few years, with events such as the ousting of previous President Evo Morales to the impact of the COVID-19 virus. Yet it seems that there is light at the end of the tunnel, at least in words, as the new president, Luis Arce, has promised to rebuild Bolivia. In the recent election, Arce swept to a landslide victory, winning some 55% of the votes against 6 other rivals on the ballot paper. But the importance of this election is the fact that Arce was the previous finance minister under Morales, hence giving hope to the electorate that the economy can emerge from the ashes. With the victory of Arce, former president Evo Morales has stated that he would now seek to return to his homeland, claiming that the new president-elect was a man who would prove that the economy could be turned around, and the belief in the party and system was the reason that Arce won the election so easily. Hello and welcome to Economic Divide with me, Omid Roshandel. On this week's show, we are going to look at the economy of Bolivia and ascertain whether the new president can use his financial experience to bring the Andean nation out of the red and back into the black. Well, have the resurgence in the party and policies once led by Morales shown that people are unhappy with the current status in Bolivia? Under Morales, for example, extreme poverty fell from 33% of the population to just 15%, showing that Morales' model and management give the poorest deciles some hope. Morales also invested heavily in the infrastructure of the country, building roads, health clinics, and schools, as well as taking the decision to nationalize both the oil and gas industries, which in all cases just mentioned, not only provided a service to the people of the country, but also created jobs and income. With Arce at the helm of the finance ministry, Morales also managed to accumulate around $15 billion of international reserves, equating to around 50% of the GDP, bringing more people out of poverty and seeing the inequality level measures on the Gini index fall from 58 to 44 points.
South America is a particularly important geopolitical area when it comes to the pendulum of the left versus right political battle. On the one hand, many South American nations have embraced the notion of left-wing-based politics, be it socialism or communism. But the point of view does not appease the foreign states, who make it their business to interfere in those such nations, and hence sees the likes of the United States, for example, place pressure on such countries, aimed ultimately at destabilizing the left. One only has to take a look at the example of Venezuela and the US distaste at the leadership of Nicolas Maduro, and the case of Cuba with the US history against Castro, and of course the dissatisfaction at the leadership in Bolivia that ultimately saw the president, Evo Morales, upstaged from his seat and removed from power in a coup. But skip forward to today, and Bolivia has once again found itself swinging to the left with the election of Luis Arce, the former finance minister of Evo Morales, who swept to victory and in doing so has promised to revive the Bolivian economy like never before. With over a decade in the role of finance minister under Morales, Arce should have the experience necessary to make educated economic and financial decisions.
I think it's going to help enormously. He had 10 years experience as a finance minister. He is very highly regarded in international circles. He presided over a period of rapid economic growth and also significant improvements in poverty reduction. So it's altogether quite a positive scenario for the future.
Yet the election results in Bolivia, although accepted by the challenger Carlos Mesa, has seen the rise of the Movement for Socialism, or the MAS party, led by Arce, spark some protests in the process, with many believing that Arce's links to Morales could see the former president return to some notion of power in the country. It's highly likely that Arce will take the issue with an air of caution, keeping Morales at arm's length as he sets to rebuild the Bolivian economy. With many nations around the world congratulating Arce on his victory, surprisingly, the US has also stepped forward with praise, recognizing the credible election process. However, it now remains to be seen as to whether the capitalist US maintain their views on the socialist Bolivians in the future, and whether the message of support is merely a disguise to be ready to stop other Latin American nations following suit.
Is Bolivia being used as a political pawn by the US? Bolivia is a very rich nation when it comes to natural resources, with the nation enjoying around 140 million tons of lithium resources buried beneath its famed salt flats, which is estimated to account for around 70% of the world's total lithium reserves, and is something that many have their eyes on. Just last year, Bolivia signed an agreement with China to the value of an initial $2.3 billion investment into the lithium available in the country, with the Chinese eyeing the use of the resource to fuel the emerging battery-powered electric vehicle market, which is estimated to be valued at over $115 billion and expected to grow fivefold by 2026. It is hence why the US were keen to see Morales go, as the U.S. only have a trade value with Bolivia to the figure of around $1 billion, with goods exported to Bolivia valued at $562 million, whilst imports, including lithium, are at $486 million.
The arrival of the coronavirus in Bolivia immediately took its toll on the recent elections held in the nation, with the original election date set to last May. However, in order to stem the rising number of cases, it was decided by the electoral bodies to postpone the election for the sake of keeping the virus in check. Yet much like the rest of South America, Bolivia is no exception when it comes to the virus, as at the time of writing, the country has seen a total of 141,000 confirmed cases of infection, with around 8,700 deaths, which compared to other nations, is still relatively low in numbers. Much like everywhere else in the world, the country has had to introduce some forms of lockdown in the bigger cities, which of course has led to store closures, offices winding down, and many other commercial and economic premises taking a hit, which for a small nation like Bolivia can have a devastating impact on their economy. With the nation receiving several loans to help it emerge from the pandemic, for example, a $254 million loan from the World Bank, how then is the Bolivian economy coping with the virus and other loans being granted to them, a benefit or a hindrance?
Bolivia has been affected by coronavirus, and it's not clear that how exact the data is coming out about that. It certainly underscores the need for a well-funded, accessible health service, which is an absolute priority to build up. And it's entirely appropriate that political leaders turn their attention to that. But with regards to the loans, that's a more worldwide question, I think. I think the IMF are strongly encouraging countries to take out loans, which is an interesting turn of events in itself.
For Bolivia, tourism is also a major source of income. However, the arrival of the virus has also taken its tolls on this sector, with the pandemic believed to be responsible for around $890 million of losses for the Bolivian Tourist Board, with around $530 million of that coming from domestic tourism and $360 million coming from inbound tourism. For the many indigenous people of Bolivia, the arrival of the COVID-19 virus is of particular importance, especially for the more isolated or rural communities who are already less exposed to viruses than others and have little or no access to healthcare facilities. For some people in the country, they've turned to traditional forms of medicine to help them through. However, as the global results have shown when it comes to dealing with the virus, the consequences of corona have been devastating, with over 1 million dead worldwide. The struggle continues for both Bolivia and the rest of the world.
Joining me in the studio today is Diego Sanchez Ancochea, a professor of political economy development from the University of Oxford. He specializes in the development and economies of Latin American nations and has worked published in various journals, including World Development and the Journal of Latin American Studies, as well as having co-edited numerous books. His current work focuses on explaining why some Latin American countries are more unequal than others. Professor, many thanks for joining our show today.
Thank you so much for the opportunity and for the invitation. It's great to be here.
Well, my first question is about Bolivia itself. We have seen that the finance minister, Luis Arce, has won a landslide victory in the election and has immediately promised to help the economy of the country grow. Now, my question is, what kind of challenges is he going to face in delivering on his promises?
So I think we should remember that Bolivia has faced, like the rest of Latin America, the combination of a health crisis and economic crisis, and in the Bolivian case, a political crisis as well in the last few months. So I think there will be two big challenges. The first is, how do they get the money from their public accounts to fund projects that are very much needed? And the other is, how do you regain political stability and sometimes of collaboration between different groups on society that have been split in recent years?
Oh, thank you. Now, your current work focuses on how Latin American nations, some of them, are more unequal than others. And my question is, how is Bolivia able to establish itself as a serious economic player in the region and beyond?
It's a great question. So Bolivia historically has been one of the most unequal countries, particularly between the indigenous population and the small white elite. But during the Morales administration in the last decade and decade and a half, actually things improved a lot. So Latin America Bolivia reduced inequality more than any other Latin American country. Of course, the big question is whether with a new president we can start back trying to reduce inequality and promote development or not, and we'll have to see in the next few months and years.
Finally, like many nations in Latin America, indigenous people play a huge part in the economics and politics of the country. How have indigenous people in Bolivia contributed to the economy of the country? And is this unwavering support for Morales and Arce a good sign for the future of the country and maybe other Latin American nations?
So another great question. So Morales' project was very much about trying to incorporate indigenous peoples and increase their political rights. And as a result, actually, a new middle class of indigenous peoples emerged, and indigenous peoples as a political force also present in the government also appeared, and it was important. The last few months, the government that replaced Morales tried to actually reverse some of these gains, but I am very hopeful that Arce will start or enhance the power of indigenous peoples, and we might actually see a new renewal of a Latin America that has more success at reducing inequalities and bringing indigenous rights to the forefront.
Professor Diego Sanchez Ancochea from the University of Oxford, many thanks for being on the show today. It was lovely hearing your thoughts on this topic.
Great talking to you, and I look forward to future occasions.
All right. Make sure you check out Professor Sanchez Ancochea's upcoming book, which is titled The Cost of Inequality in Latin America, published by I.B. Torres, and available for pre-order now from the usual outlets. Bolivia, as we know, is the world's largest producer of lithium. Let's now take a look at how lithium is playing a part in one of the world's most lucrative emerging markets in our next report.
Bolivia is said to hold around 25% of the world's total lithium resources, with some estimates placing it as high as 70%. Along with Chile and Argentina, Bolivia make up the so-called lithium triangle, with the metal being concentrated in various salt plains around South America, covering the Atacama Desert and its neighboring areas. Some have called the exploration and mining of the metal as the White Gold Rush, with a total value on the market of an estimated $5.9 billion across the world, with the potential of the market rising in the near future, in part sparked by one certain industry. With the world paying more attention to the carbon footprint issue, many of the world's leading car makers are now turning their attention to the electric car market, which, as we all know, relies heavily on batteries inside the vehicles, which, of course, are mainly fueled by lithium. Sales of electric cars topped 2.1 million units in 2019, with total electric car sales accounting for 2.6% of the global market. However, zero-emission vehicles are set to rise dramatically over the next decade, with diesel vehicle production for one seeing an eventual phase-out, followed by likely, one day, petrol. One of the biggest emerging markets in the electrical vehicle production line is China, who are already home to the largest number of electrical vehicle charging points in the world, suggesting that the Chinese will no doubt be eyeing the rest of the world for them to place their electrical vehicles, hence competing with some very big players. So will Bolivia's vast resources of lithium come to the rescue of the Bolivian economy, in particular when it comes to assisting in the production of batteries for electric vehicles?
It's a bit complicated. Bolivia forms part of what's called the Lithium Triangle with Argentina and Chile. And frankly, both Argentina, but particularly Chile, have moved faster than Bolivia had in terms of developing those resources. Bolivia has one quarter of the known resources of in the world of lithium. The problem is it's found at a higher altitude than in Chile and Argentina, and technically it is more complicated to produce lithium hydroxide or lithium carbonate, which is the key compound which is used for batteries.
But should Bolivia instead be wary and consider the notion of killing two birds with one stone? When Evo Morales was in power, he suggested that Bolivia should not only produce the lithium to sell abroad to make batteries, but also consider the idea of building the batteries themselves, hence adding another layer to the economy, and leaving something for Arce to consider in his upcoming term, and promise of rebuilding the economy.
I'm pleased to welcome back into the studio our regular current affairs and impact analyst, Mohan Albedin. Mohan, thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome.
So, people in Bolivia have made a very bold political statement by electing Arce, the former finance minister. But what are the economic impacts of this election on the country?
Well, absolutely. So, it was a surprise electoral victory a week or so ago. So, the socialists are back. Now, we have the tweet here, victory against U.S. imperialism. Well, yes, but then the really serious issues about rebuilding partnerships with China and just generally going back to the, you know, the Evo Morales philosophy of building the country from bottom up. And of course, in Bolivia, the story isn't just political. It's,
right.
it's social, it's kind of ethnic, because Morales, if you like, he represented, or he purported to represent the indigenous people. Who have historically been dispossessed and impoverished in Bolivia. So this is a really big story. And I think the victors in this election have got their work cut out, to be honest, in terms of putting the economy on a stable footing.
So next.
So Luis Arce's most pressing challenge, economy, obviously, like everywhere else, is a huge concern for the Bolivians, more so than COVID-19. So again, this just speaks to the big challenges ahead, really. Let's not forget, this is an impoverished country. Even by Latin American standards, it's very poor. But I would add to that the foreign policy challenge, or at least the regional challenge, because Bolivia now is in a kind of a hostile environment. You have Brazil that has this kind of looks to Trump. Mm-hmm. So by extension, they're an enemy of Bolivia. You have Colombia, which is very belligerent, led by a right-wing regime. Their only ally, really, is Venezuela, and they have problems of their own. So, third and final tweet you have. So, it's had good growth, big reductions in poverty. It's a mixed picture, really. So, I mean, under Morales, they followed this Venezuelan policy of helping the indigenous people. The only problem with that is if you focus on one group, so by extension, by definition, you're going to impoverish or at least disadvantage another group. I think what this new Bolivian regime needs above all is to show national unity, to demonstrate it can look after the economic well-being of all the Bolivian people. And I think that is the route to success for them. Because I mean, if you read from this tweet, and this is very accurate actually, it captures all their problems in a very pithy tweet. But so really, they need a holistic approach.
Wrap it up. I can say we are hopeful, but it's not going to be easy.
This was a very pleasant victory, I think. I think it puts aside all the difficulties from last year, because last year there was an ugly coup in Bolivia. There was a lot of violence. A lot of people were hurt. This at least is an opportunity to correct those wrongs.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as they can get the good policies in place, they have a good future, I think.
Mohan, thank you so much for joining us today as well. That was Mohan Albedin, our regular current affairs and impact analyst. Now, in our final report today, we take a look at how Bolivia compares to and interacts with its neighboring countries in Latin America. So stay right where you are.
South America, as we recently discovered in our recent program right here on Economic Divide, where we covered the Inter-American Development Bank, is a highly complex continent, especially when one studies it on an economic level. On the one hand, you have a country such as Brazil, a nation that sits comfortably in the top 10 of the world's largest GDPs, with over $2.05 trillion per year income, and hence making it a key emerging power. On the other hand, you have a country like Argentina, a nation which is on the verge of a second financial crisis and is about to see its currency plummet in value. Across South America, there's also a whole host of layers in between. For Bolivia, relations with its neighbours is highly important, in particular as Bolivia is a landlocked country and access to ports are limited. It's hence why Bolivia and Chile, for example, have clashed in the past when it comes to this particular benefit. So how are Bolivian relations with their neighbours now?
That region, like you've mentioned, Brazil, Argentina, Chile, Chile as well, they're also they're the big players in that region. Bolivia gets compared more often to Peru. One of the key challenges for Bolivia is really to turn its economy away from reliance on natural resources. So diversifying the economy in general, which could include some exploitation of natural resources, but diversifying it so there's not so much of a reliance is key
But it's not just nation states that Bolivia interact with, the nation also playing a role in liaising with international institutions, which also see relations appearing to look promising for Bolivia.
Internationally, with the International Monetary Fund, relations I think are probably going to be not as bad as people might think. IMF has recently been going through a kind of mea culpa, and this noticeable shift in its approach to poverty reduction and income distribution and taxation of international wealth. So I think Arce in some ways fits the mold there with this new thinking in the IMF.
However, like many other nations in South America, it's the interaction with the US that ultimately many want to address. The arrival of Evo Morales certainly soured ties between the two, with the unionist Morales proving popular with farmers and locals in Bolivia as he sought to eradicate US policy in the country, going as far to say that wherever there's a US ambassador, there's a coup. How right he was. As mentioned earlier in the show, with the arrival of Arce at the helm and Pompeo sending his wishes, will the US's warm approach to Bolivia be nothing more than a wolf in sheep's clothing?
For many countries in South America, the resistance to U.S. imperialism is a fact of everyday life, with Venezuela and Bolivia being prime examples of such policy. It is hence why the comeback of an indigenous party in Bolivia is being hailed as a miracle by some, with the working class front lines clearly defending the people of the country. With the U.S. having been involved in so many regime changes around the world, the onus is now on Bolivia and President-elect Luis Arce to show that the nation can, in fact, stand on its own two feet, embrace its natural resources, and most importantly, set an example to other nations in the region and beyond as to how to stand up to imperialist capitalism. What now remains to be seen is whether other nations in the region will follow this example and see foreign interference in regional affairs become a thing of the past. That's all about the time we have for this episode. On behalf of myself, Omid Roshandel, and the whole team here on Economic Divide, stay safe. We'll see you again next time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In a series of unhinged tweets on Saturday morning, November 7th, most of which were marked by the social media company as containing information that is disputed or might be misleading about an election or other civic process, Trump lied to the world without providing a shred of evidence that massive fraud has taken place since Election Day. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by John Quilley, writer. This article is published under the heading "Trump Effort to Steal Election." And so national chaos is taking place in broad daylight. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. Vanquishing President Donald Trump, Democratic nominee Joe Biden was announced winner of the 2020 presidential election on Saturday, November 7th, and is now slated to become the 46th President of the United States of America. Major news outlets, including NBC News and the Associated Press, made their official projections late on Saturday morning, November 7th. Shortly before the race was called, President Donald Trump continued his brazen effort to spew misinformation as a way to steal the presidential election away from the American people, even as the results up to that point, based on a steady counting of ballots nationwide and in key states, all showed that Joe Biden was almost certainly on the verge of being the next president of the United States. In a series of unhinged tweets on Saturday morning, November 7th, most of which were marked by the social media company as containing information that is disputed or might be misleading about an election or other civic process, Trump lied to the world without providing a shred of evidence that massive fraud has taken place since Election Day, as the state election offices counted an unprecedented amount of mail-in absentee and provisional ballots cast this year due to the COVID-19 pandemic. At 10:36 a.m. Eastern Time, Trump asserted, "I won this election by a lot." There was, however, only one possible fact-based response to such a clear lie, and that would be, "No, you didn't." According to the New York Times, at the time Trump issued those tweets, Biden was leading the president in the Electoral College race by a margin of 253-214, and the national popular vote by 4,150,184. And, as was predicted almost word by word by people like Senator Bernie Sanders, who warned exactly of this kind of nightmare scenario, instead of getting ready to concede, as he inched towards inevitable defeat to his Democratic rival, Trump instead wrapped himself in a thick blanket of falsehoods to claim that a huge number of ballots cast against him were fraudulent as a way to delegitimize the election and sow massive distrust and unrest among his supporters. According to the Associated Press, earlier on Saturday, November 7th, Biden was edging closer to win with a final call in Pennsylvania, all he needed to secure overall victory in the Electoral College race by 270. As AP reported early in the day, prior to a final batch of reported votes which put him over the top, the delay in producing a verdict could be attributed to high turnout, a massive number of mail-in ballots, and slim margins between the candidates. Biden held leads in Pennsylvania, Nevada, and Georgia, putting him in a stronger position to capture the 270 Electoral College votes needed to take the White House. There was intense focus on Pennsylvania, where Biden led Trump by more than 28,000 votes, and Nevada, where Biden was up by about 22,000. The prolonged wait added to the anxiety of a nation facing historic challenges, including the surging coronavirus pandemic and deep political polarization. Meanwhile, Trump renewed his offense by making baseless claims of fraud. Bad things took place during those hours where legal transparency was viciously and crudely not allowed, stated at 8:20 a.m. Eastern Time via his Twitter account. Tractors, blocked doors, and windows were covered with thick cardboard so that observers could not see into the account rooms. Bad things happen inside. Big changes took place, he added. Not a word of this is substantiated, but that didn't stop the president from saying it to his millions of supporters. Since election night, when Trump outrageously claimed he already did win the election, Trump has refused to acknowledge the legitimate vote counting process and instead used the ensuing days. While Biden called for patience and assured Americans that every vote must be counted to deepen his conspirational proclamations, Trump's efforts, say progressive critics, are about much more than just lying and deceit, but should be seen as an outright effort to steal the election. As Esquire's Jack Holmes wrote on Friday, November 6th, the whole situation in the United States is incredibly easy to understand and clear to see. What is now happening has been coming, and it's been incredibly obvious for months. Well, years. In 2016, Trump said he would only consider the election legitimate if he won. Even when he won, he greeted the news he'd gotten shellac in the popular vote by saying 3 million of those votes were fraudulent. 3 million! And yet, when he created an entire presidential commission to investigate, they found nothing and disbanded. Then he ransacked the institutions of democracy for 4 years, undermining the separation of powers and the independent system of justice and the free press, until this election was approaching and he once again said he'd only lose if it was rigged. The president said he would scream fraud if he lost, and now that he's losing, he's a screaming fraud while providing zero count admissible evidence, continued Holmes. This isn't complicated. Trump announced on Twitter that he would hold a big press conference at 11:30 a.m. Eastern Time, but that event never materialized.
Outgoing US President Donald Trump made it no secret that he was on the warpath when it came to China. Not only did he spark a contentious trade war with the Chinese, but he also brazenly stated that the COVID-19 virus was Chinese-made, sparking notions of racism, which, along with his disastrous handling of the virus in the US, likely cost him his place at the White House. It's therefore strange to see a senior US Air Force commander stating that US troops in the region should prepare for conflict in the near future, echoing tones stated by Chinese President Xi Jinping during a recent visit to a military barracks in China. In spite of the ongoing election saga taking place in the US, the Americans claim that the Chinese are taking part in malicious activities around the Pacific Rim, and in particular in the South China Sea, stating that China is misaligned with international law. Yet it can be argued that the polar opposite is true, as the US seek to provoke and agitate the Chinese by sending senior representatives to Taiwan, as well as stoking the flames in the recent tensions in Hong Kong, suggesting that if anyone should be claiming foul play, it's the Chinese over the Americans. It therefore remains to be asked as to whether the Americans are more eager to start a conflict than China. With the US already embroiled in a host of conflicts around the world, could the US then be seeking to start another with its greatest rival China, not only to cement its place as a world power, but also to stem the rise of the Chinese emerging as a threat to the US hegemony?
I can say that for sure this kind of provocative statement they come from the United States. They don't come from China. From China, there is no, basically no statement or will to provoke a war, basically.
When Donald Trump paid a visit to India, many claim that the partnership formed between Modi and Trump was aimed at sending a message to another regional player, namely China. And it seems that the predictions were correct. The US has also expanded its regional and global sphere of influence further, as it seems that both Germany and Australia have joined the Americans and Indians in the region by performing military exercises in the area, clearly adding another US-backed layer of provocation towards China.
There are many countries involved, but from my point of view, I will say just the countries that are, for sure in the alliance with the United States. I will mention Japan, South Korea, definitely Vietnam, India, and Australia.
Yet with the election of President-elect Joe Biden to the White House, we may see the U.S. reverse its rhetoric towards China, as Biden attempts to pick up the pieces left behind from the Trump legacy. However, there's one very worrying factor in the equation, namely that Trump still has until the end of January before handing over power to Biden, meaning that the unstable president may still have a trick or two up his sleeve, including the temptation of testing the very massive military that he leads. But as Trump finds himself on the way out, many of those surrounding him have also distanced themselves from the outgoing president, including a vital piece of the conflict puzzle, Defense Secretary Mark Esper, who has prepared his resignation letter for Trump. But for now, it's probably safe to say that all attention has been diverted away from a conflict between the US and China as the Americans enter a transition period, and Biden waits with anticipation to tell Trump, "You're fired."
Israel is undoubtedly an opportunist regime. It once again proved that this week when it escalated demolitions of Palestinian homes as international media were focused on the presidential election in the United States. On Tuesday, the Israeli army carried out the biggest demolition of Palestinian homes in the occupied West Bank for a decade. It razed to the ground the homes of nearly 80 Palestinians, mostly children, in the Bedouin village of Herbet Homsa in the Jordan Valley. The Israeli army made sure that nothing was left of the Palestinian structures, which included homes, animal shelters, and solar panels. Palestinians say they had no idea what was about to happen to their homes. The Israelis moved in without prior notice and gave them 10 minutes to evacuate before they started bulldozing. These families are now left homeless and have nowhere to go. Vehicles and tractors belonging to the Palestinians were also taken away. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shataya denounced the latest Israeli crime in the occupied territories. Shataya urged the international community to intervene against Israel's attempt to displace the citizens of the Bedouin village and tens of similar Palestinian communities from their homes and lands. The Palestinian premier highlighted the fact that Israel chose Tuesday night to carry out the demolition because global attention was focused on the high-profile vote in America. The demolition drew condemnation from the United Nations and the European Union. So far this year, 689 Palestinian structures have been razed to the ground across the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem al-Quds. The UN says the number is more than the figures in any full year since 2016. Meanwhile, the European Union has highlighted the fact that over 50 Palestinian schools are currently under the threat of Israeli demolition. The Israeli army routinely destroys Palestinian structures in the occupied territories. Anything built without hard-to-get permits, rarely issued by Israel, is at risk of demolition by the Israeli army. Demolition of Palestinian structures and expansion of Israeli settlements are unending. Israeli settlements have been mushrooming in the occupied territories over the past decades. Widespread international condemnation has failed to dissuade the regime from such actions. Pro-Palestinian activists believe even the toughest verbal denunciation do very little to stop such violations of international law. They want the United Nations, the European Union, and other organizations to use their economic leverage with Israel to force the regime to halt its illegal action.
Well, the majority of the EU's exports to the illegal Zionist entity actually come through settlements. So while the EU issues a lot of condemnation of Israel over its illegal settlements, it needs to really put its condemnation into practice by withdrawing from a lot of its economic and bilateral agreements.
Palestinians have been fighting an uphill battle against the Israeli occupation for decades. Things are perhaps tougher today as several Arab states are abandoning the Palestinian cause and normalizing their ties with Israel. Palestinians say those Arab states are stabbing them in the back. As many governments refuse to pressure the regime, Palestinians are hoping popular grassroots campaigns against Israel will one day bear fruit.
European countries are announcing varying degrees of lockdowns amid a second wave of the coronavirus pandemic and fears that the surge in the number of infections would strain hospital wards across the continent. Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte announced a 6 p.m. curfew for the country's restaurants and cafes, calling for national unity. He said the restrictions can be eased if the infection curve is kept under control. French President Emmanuel Macron decreed a new national lockdown lasting until at least the 1st of December. He warned that the second wave of the outbreak in the country can prove to be even deadlier than the first. In Belgium, Prime Minister Alexander De Croo expressed hope that a team of 11 million citizens would come together in following more stringent regulations. The United Kingdom has also joined the countries that have announced nationwide lockdowns for the second time.
And so now is the time to take action because there is no alternative. And from Thursday until the start of December, you must stay at home. You may only leave home for specific reasons.
Boris Johnson added that all non-essential retail stores will close down, but there would be no need for citizens to stock up.
Things are very bad in Europe at the moment. The general mass of the population has lost confidence in the government because of their mishandling, and I would say even criminal negligence surrounding COVID-19 since the beginning. China, for example, went on full lockdown on January the 23rd for 6 weeks and is now on top of it. Normal life has returned, and the economic growth for which China is well known has been restored because China had what's called a full lockdown.
The stringent measures come as the country's confirmed COVID-19 infections exceeded 1 million, with over 20,000 cases being reported daily. The economic fallout of the coronavirus pandemic, massive layoffs, and rising unemployment levels in Europe have added to already lingering concerns about public health. The mayors of 9 cities have bypassed their national governments to write directly to the president of the European Council, Charles Michel, demanding access to the 750 billion euro EU recovery fund. Protesters from across the continent are calling on their governments to provide greater financial support to those hit worst by the pandemic. In Italy, a tipping point appears to be disturbingly close. Angry demonstrations erupted in Naples just over a week ago after a local curfew was imposed. The protests were followed by a civil order in Milan and Turin, where luxury stores were looted. A poll following last week's mini-riots found that over three-quarters of Italians believe there will be more violence in the streets this winter. Experts also believe it is quite likely that countries like France that witnessed unprecedented strikes and protests before the pandemic even began face serious social unrest.
The potential economic damage from the virus and from new lockdowns is of course very considerable. Already we've seen European economies shrink at times during this year, and several governments, including the British government, have introduced financial schemes to help companies keep people employed. So, for example, here in Britain, we've had what's called a furlough scheme, where companies are paid 80% of workers' wages while they are in fact at home, not working. But of course, that will be very, very expensive for the country, and Britain and other countries in Europe are running up huge debts and deficits, which will have to be paid off one day.
The stakes were remarkably high before the first lockdowns were imposed back in March, but they may be even higher now. In yet another embarrassment for the US government, new evidence has come to light that a plot aimed at overthrowing the government of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has shown that the very highest echelons of Washington were aware of what was about to happen, as the plans appear to have been conceived in a Trump-owned complex. The apparent coup plot was instigated in the so-called Trump Doral, a golf course in Florida, where the alleged perpetrators of the act met on the green grass of the 12th fairway, planning to overthrow Nicolas Maduro while circumnavigating the bunkers of the golf course in the process. The failed coup saw dozens of people arrested by Venezuelan forces, with many of the detained being US citizens and having links to the US-backed Juan Guaido, hence proving that the US are more than certainly involved in the plot. The clear failure by the mercenaries to overthrow Maduro in the coup shows that in spite of having one of the world's largest military forces, as well as having an almost blank checkbook funded by the CIA, the Americans have a long way to go before they are able to upstage any government in South America, or for that matter, anywhere else in the world, suggesting that the US attempt to fund a coup in Venezuela is a clear failure and an embarrassment for the Americans.
Yeah, absolutely does. It's a catastrophic failure. Just an utterly sort of laughable, pathetic, you know, Bay of Piglets, as it was referred to by many. Not a very terribly serious seeming coup attempt in terms of what the United States has done in the past, but a coup attempt nonetheless. Absolutely, Trump administration's fingerprints are all over this, although officially Vice President Pence has described this lawsuit that we see now from Jordan Goudreau, who is sort of in charge of plotting this coup and signing it with would-be sort of pseudo-president Juan Guaido, who is in fact obviously not the president of any sovereign territory or country.
Yeah, as with multiple lies delivered by the US and their failed foreign policy attempts, the embarrassing failure in Venezuela is yet another notch that the US can add to their miseries when trying to destabilize any nation around the world, especially a nation that's shown the ability and skill to resist, much to the shame of Washington. It seems that the US does not seem to care whether it succeeds or fails when it comes to its foreign policies, with example after example showing that failures are part and parcel of the US statecraft that we've all seen over the last few decades. So-called intelligence leads in the past have all shown how the lies justified by the Americans and their allies have all come to no results, and have left all the decision-makers at the top very red-faced in the process, with one such example of seeing the Saddam regime in possession of weapons of mass destruction. This is clearly the best example of them all. But in spite of the clear failures demonstrated by the US and its proxies, the fact that they can continue as if nothing had happened in the first place is something that needs to be addressed. Yet it's something that appears to be just another story brushed under the carpet, in spite of evidence clearly showing that the Americans were wrong in the first place. The question that now remains to be asked is whether the US are happy to live and let live when it comes to such massive failures. Or will the red mist settle in front of the eyes of the hawks in Washington, D.C., and mean that the U.S. will seek to gain revenge in the future in ever more harder and brutal ways?
Although I am generally hesitant to draw any real distinction between the foreign policy of the Democrats and Republicans in the sense that they both sort of ultimately want similar things, which is to say U.S. domination of the world's people and resources, there may be some differences here in terms of the presidential election in the United States. Donald Trump obviously is playing to a very far-right fringe of Venezuelans, wealthy elite Venezuelans who live in Florida. These people are not representative, of course, of any of the normal Venezuelan population, nor are they representative of the normal Florida population.
The truth of the matter is, however, that the attempted coup in Venezuela, for example, is nothing more than an easily deniable event of the past, and is something that, like many other US-backed destabilizing techniques, will remain nothing more than a story gracing the pages of Wikipedia, hence allowing the US to continue their calamitous foreign policies, safe in the knowledge that the denial policy is always best, and that any stories that do eventually emerge will never be acted upon. A new study has shown that so far in 2020, Americans have purchased at least 17 million firearms. According to Small Arms Analytics, this is more than any other single year since records began. Gun sales across the country had already seen a surge in the spring because of the coronavirus pandemic, but they spiked even higher in the summer of widespread protests and anger over systematic racism. The demonstrations began following the police killing of an African-American, George Floyd. Small Arms Analytics says by August, the US had exceeded last year's total. By September, the US exceeded the highest total ever. It added that the number of guns sold through the end of September 2020 is not only more than last year, it's more than any full year in the last 20 years we have records for. The revelation clearly highlights the levels of unrest the United States has witnessed this year.
There's been a tremendous amount of unrest here in the United States. There has been the Black Lives Matter movement. There's killings almost every day of black people by police and by white supremacists. So there's a real sense of panic among certain parts of the population.
According to the analytics company, the previous record for estimated firearms sold in a single year was 16.6 million. That was in 2016, when Hillary Clinton ran for president against Donald Trump and endorsed a strong gun control platform. Groups that advocate for an end to gun violence say that the surge in firearm sales will only increase the level of domestic violence. According to researchers at the University of California, gun purchases from March to May, linked to the coronavirus pandemic, were also associated with a nearly 8% rise in firearm violence across the United States. That's an estimated 776 additional shooting injuries. With much more ammunition on the streets, there's more fear across the towns and cities of America. A recent report by the Department of Homeland Security says groups and individuals with white supremacist ideologies pose a deadliest terror threat to the United States. Many of these right-wing extremists are armed and have also expressed support for President Trump. The fear is that deadly chaos could ensue if the country's presidential election on Tuesday is disputed by the incumbent. The eldest son of the late civil rights leader Martin Luther King says he fears that the election will bring about another civil war. Martin Luther King III said this is down to the kind of leadership the president has provided.
Without saying it, you know, the president doesn't say that, but he says what he needs to give people comfort in feeling that it's all right for them to say that this is what's going to happen. They themselves have said we're getting prepared for the Civil War. But everybody is buying ammunition, and it's not one side, by the way. You've got Democrats and Republicans who are gunning up.
Gun owners say months of sustained demand for firearms this year has resulted in a shortage of guns and ammunition. Long queues have been seen at gun stores. The highest sales are adding millions of weapons to a nation that already has more guns than people. With increased political polarization, racial tensions, and anger at coronavirus deaths, as well as lockdown restrictions, those post-election fears are not going to disappear.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.